So today is Monday, June 11th, 2018. I'm Sarah Lang with the Oral History Program at UW-Madison. I'm talking with Walter Tisdale, book artist, UW alum, and founder of Tatlin Books and Landlocked Press, and we're at the University Archives and Steenbach Library. So Walter, could you start by telling us a little bit about your family and where you grew up?
Well, I grew up in Portland, Maine.
Okay.
And lived there up and through high school. I went off to college. And it was your classic 1950s, 60s elementary school. Everyone in your neighborhood goes to school. You go home for lunch. There were 35 kids in my kindergarten class. And I met 11 of them a couple of years ago. There wasn't a lot of art programs in public schools then. And then I started to develop some, what turned out to be a learning disability. And in fifth grade, my mom got a scholarship for me to go to a private school. And they had two art teachers. They had a kiln. So that's, I had done a lot of drawing on my own. But from about fifth grade on, I was taking art classes, either at the local university or at school, and then taking private lessons with different art teachers. So I've always been involved in drawing and painting, but mostly drawing. I love to draw. And then when I went to high school, I went to a Catholic Jesuit high school. They didn't have an art program either.
Okay.
So I, that lapsed for 4 years. And I was plenty busy with other activities. And then I went to college. I went to a private school in upstate New York, Colgate University. And I started to take art courses again.
Okay.
And I was an English major. I don't know if I'm going too fast here. And I had a very influential professor who would suggest alternate subjects for me to study. And that's when I sort of discovered the book world. And I had read a review of a show at the Pierpont Morgan Library called William Morris and the Art of the Book. And I knew about William Morris and the whole arts and crafts, his involvement in architecture. Didn't know a lot about book design, though. I knew him primarily as an author and as a designer of furniture. So that's when I discovered the ingenious way libraries are set up. If you go to a card catalog and looking for a particular book, and then when you go to that shelf, you realize there's all these other books. So I really became sort of devoted to studying the history of the book. And based on that one catalog from the Pierpont Morgan Library, so I got interested in type design. So a lot of my early interest was really British focused. So I knew all about typefaces, and there was one particular book published by the University of Oxford Press called Methods of Book Design. And because in my childhood I'd had a learning disability, one of the easiest curves, and I had a mother who was a teacher, our best and favorite Christmas presents were books. So I was a voracious reader. So I always, it's just, what was profound for me when I discovered this book on methods of book design was I'd never thought of how books are put together. The way kids today don't think of the milk they might pour from a container, where it comes from. So that was a revelation to think, gee, you know, actually people have to make books. And if a book is well put together, you don't really think about the design. It engages you in the book. That's the beauty of good design. So from my childhood on, I just read books incessantly. And then suddenly the light bulb went off. Making books. But where were you going to do that? Certainly wasn't part of any of the training I'd had in public school, private school, or college. So I just continued down the path of reading as much as I could about books, book design, book history, graphic design. And I was seeking out materials on my own, going to libraries. And then I just started to discover that many libraries were not set up to have people wandering the stacks. So you could go to a research library like at Purdue or here at the University in Madison, and wander the stacks and find beautifully handmade books that really should be in a protected environment, but when the libraries were set up, they really were, because you would come, in the old days, you'd come to the, go to the card catalog, get the number, go to the desk, and they'd retrieve the book for you. So I started to devote my interest into going to libraries and finding these books, seeing if what books they would have available on the shelf that I could go look at.
Mm-hmm.
So that was just, it was getting finer, closer and closer to the point where I started to think, well, geez, maybe I would like to learn how to make books. But again, there was no place that I was aware of where you could do that. So I think I've always been a reader.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really guided a lot of my interest in making books. And the text, to me, is the kind of books. I like designing, creating books that start with a text
mm-hmm.
and work out from there. And I think it's because I've always been a reader first. And then, fast forward to Madison, that's where I met this range of opportunities. So my early childhood was just typically happy reading and living in the same neighborhood for my whole life. I think that's something that I don't take for granted anymore.
And how was that beneficial?
I just think, my mom was a history teacher. She raised mm-hmm. five boys by herself. I just think you get comfortable with where you're living, and then you start small and you work out from there. But I think the fact that we didn't move around a lot, I think that was I don't know if it's an advantage in life, but it was certainly something that I've come to, and that when I had my own family, we were lucky to be able to stay in the same spot. I've been in Bangor 31 years now. And I've seen, it's just the way it was like when I was growing up.
Mm-hmm.
So, I feel like I've been very lucky all along in that respect. But the art classes, as influential as they were when I was younger,
mm-hmm.
there were so many breaks. The civic break was in high school. I think most schools do have art programs, very vigorous ones. And mm-hmm. I think that 4 years was kind of a drought, and I didn't really think about making art during those 4 years because it wasn't an option.
When you were in college, did you take art classes?
I did.
What kinds of classes?
I was an English major. And I was also very interested in architecture, because where I grew up in Portland, Maine, within a city block, you might have, it was started from the federal period right up through some colonial, but federal, all the significant architectural movements were often within a block. So I was seeing all these beautiful buildings. And so I always had in the back of my mind I wanted to be an architect.
Okay.
And which was a curious thing. I remember adults asking me, well, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I would say an architect. And I know I can understand the smiles that I got back in return. And I discovered later in life that architecture, certainly someone like William Morris, architecture and books they're really the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that was just because of the buildings I grew up around. Architecture was something that was important to me, just the details, the design, and it's something you live and walk through. And I lived in the same city my whole life, but we moved, depending on circumstances, we moved five times within six blocks.
Okay.
So we lived in different homes, and they were all mid-19th century homes. So just seeing the fact that these homes had back stairs where in the old days where the servants could come and go,
mm-hmm.
third floors that were fully furnished with bathrooms, bedrooms, those were our playrooms. So when I moved out here to the Midwest, I remember always saying to my friend, we're already back stairs. I'd never lived in a house or been in a house that didn't have a set of back stairs.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think the little things, I think that helped me as a making books, seeing the little details. of architecture and books. It's really the same language. You're building something that is going to be used on a daily basis, or something that when you open a book, it has the same passages working through the pages.
Did you end up taking any architecture classes in school?
When I moved to Milwaukee. Mm-hmm. My dad lived in Milwaukee, so when I moved to Wisconsin, I had a girlfriend who's from Madison and going to school here. She was in an ag program. And I lived for a couple of months with my dad in Milwaukee. I went to a seminar. They had a big Frank Lloyd Wright symposium. Mm-hmm. Then I moved to Madison, and I had some, in the building I lived in, there were some architecture students. And they did everything they could to discourage me from going to architecture school, because they were supremely unhappy. It wasn't what they thought they were going to. So that influenced me. I thought, well, I always wanted to be an architect, but they're telling me that I'd be frustrated because my idea of what was architecture was 19th century.
Okay.
They said you would maybe get to design a small feature of a whole design project. They may give you one little project, but you're not going to be the mastermind behind, unless you own the company. So that was sort of an eye opener. Thinking, and I was when I came to Madison, I came here to live, and I, because all my friends grew up in here, they scrupulously avoided the university. So I lived here 2 years before I even set foot on campus.
Oh, really?
And that sort of colored my experience in Madison. Madison was just a great place to live and work. I lived on the west side, worked on the west side. And when I did come on campus, it was usually at the in the ag part of the campus.
Sure.
So I didn't really move here to go to school. Okay. And that set me apart, as it turns out. And I ended up living here 10 years.
And where were you working when you first moved?
At a bookstore.
You were? Okay. And what was the bookstore?
It was called Book Markets. Okay. And there was a big magazine chain in Chicago, and they had a chain of bookstores.
Mm-hmm.
So they were the biggest, one of the largest magazine distributors in the Midwest. If not the largest in the Midwest, one of the biggest in the country. So this was a sideline. They were trying to see, can we we sell all of our magazines to bookstores, why not? So I think it was the most northern satellite they had.
Okay.
And I worked there for 2.5 years. And that, Madison was zealous about granting residency.
Uh-huh.
It's tough to get, at least back then, if they thought you had moved here to go to work so you could go to school, they would deny you residency.
Okay.
So it was really scrupulous. When I decided to start taking classes, I had to get interviewed to determine my status. I was clearly a resident, I had a license, worked here, paid taxes. However, did I come here to go to school? That would have been disqualifying. So my residence counselor was one of our best customers. So when I walked through the door, she's, oh, well, end of the interview. I know who you are. So that was, again, just one of those lucky things. Because
mm-hmm.
I had a friend whose wife she was working full-time at financial aid. Her husband was a grad student, and he could never get residency.
Mm-hmm.
So his 3 years at MFA, he was paying out-of-state tuition.
Okay.
So that helped. That was one of those lucky things.
Yeah. So what made you decide to go to Madison, go to the UW after you'd been here for a while?
Well, I was starting to think maybe that I could, I had a friend who was in the art department. He was a master's student, and I knew him through a girlfriend. And he and I took a history of the book class in the library department.
Okay.
Dorothea Scott was the teacher. And so it meant I had to get into the system, and they had this special student category then.
Mm-hmm.
It was a little building that's now torn down. And I was taking, because I was working full time, so I was taking classes when I could fit them in. My job was 3 to 9 at night, so that meant I could take morning classes, or even early afternoon classes to get to work in time. So I took this class, History of the Book, and I had met this fellow a couple times, but he and I sort of boon companions by the end of the semester, because the teacher would call on him when she wasn't sure about something typographic. But she taught the class through overlays, and it was a 120 class. It was fairly deadly boring. So he always had to be awake because she might ask him a question.
Uh-huh.
So we were given an option. You can write a term paper. And there was a famous cartographer, David Woodward, who had taken the class, and his term paper was about a map that turned out to be the first printed map in America.
Okay.
So we were all like, well, no one's going to be able to top that one.
Uh-huh.
So we came up with the idea of doing an exhibition. We approached her and said, could we mount an exhibition? So we went to the rare book room, and we were able to gather books that were in the stacks.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the printing press that was by Harry Duncan, the Cummington Press. So we got exhibition space, and the two of us mounted an exhibition in lieu of a term paper.
Okay.
Of the Cummington Press. And by then, he had said, do you want to come over and see my studio? And I'm pretty sure this was the spring of 79.
Okay.
So when I walked into his studio, I saw the printing press, the type, and he was from a graphic design family. So this was all natural to him. That's when I said, I really want to learn how to make books. And I found the person who was Walter Hamady.
Mm-hmm.
But there were many more people other than me who wanted to get in the class. So I was not a regular student. And at that point, that was my first special studies class as a special student. So how was I going to get into Walter Hamady's class? And John Bennett coached me and said, well, back then you used to have to go to I can't remember what they called it. It was a building with a dirt floor to get your registration forms.
Oh, yeah.
And the special students showed up on Friday.
Mm-hmm.
When all the classes were filled. So you pretty much got to pick over the dregs, if you were lucky. So the art department, those big bucks, they didn't want to hang around all week waiting for people to show up. So they would do most of the bargaining on Monday, which was the grad students. So if you showed up and with a portfolio, typically, or could make a pitch to the professor, they would give you a blue card. Say, let this person in. And then this was on a Monday.
Mm-hmm.
Then on the day that, like, my day was a Friday, so I was a special student. So on Friday, I would go to the office, give them the blue card, and I was in the class. Well, I didn't know that system. John was the one who told me about it. So he told me how to bluff my way into the class. So that's what I did. I went up there Monday, and they're all sitting around, all visiting, because this was now the fall of 79. They'd all had the summer off, and they were all in a congenial mood. And they were going to wrap things, usually they wrap things up by noon.
Okay.
All the classes were filled. So it didn't make a difference if you registered on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. You showed up, there was no one there. So you had to know you had to be there Monday.
Okay.
To get your blue card, to get into the class. So I went and made my case, and he let me in the class. But he let me in the class because I said John Bennett and I had done this exhibition on the Cummington Press. And that was one of Walter's mentors.
Okay.
What was Harry Duncan. Harry and his favorite aunt, were childhood friends. And when Walter was visiting his childhood friend, visiting his favorite aunt in Keokuk, Iowa, Harry was printing a book. And that's the first time Walter had. She said, "Well, if you're interested in books, you should go meet my friend Harry." So Walter's always told this story that that's the first time he saw someone making a book. Harry was using a hand press, a book of James Agee's short stories, uncollected short stories. So when I said to Walter I had done this exhibition to Harry Duncan, and then I bluffed my way, but I knew all about the history, and he let me in the class, so I got my blue card.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started taking just his class, because that's the only time I had, and I was working full time. So at a certain point, I had accrued enough credits, and there was a legendary dean in the special students who was her hobby to track people like me.
Uh-huh.
So when I went to get my registration form, there was a hold on it. They said, "You have a hold on your transcript." I said, "Why is that?" She said, "Well, you have to go see Prudy Stewart, She wants to see you before she's going to let you register for your next class. So I had to go see her. And she's interviewed me. And she said, what are you doing? You've got a lot of credits here. Have you been to college before? I said, well, I've been to Colgate 2 years. Well, get me a transcript. I'll let you register this semester, but you have to get a transcript from Colgate. And we're going to sit down before the next semester and see where you stand. So she's the one who encouraged me to think about becoming an art student.
Okay.
Because I had 2 years of credits at Colgate, and by that point I had probably four classes under Walter.
Mm-hmm.
And so she's the one who pushed me into the fact that you've got enough credits here, you're just a year and a half away, you could have a degree.
Mm-hmm.
And I later had a friend who was an assistant dean of humanities, and he said that was her specialty. You got prudied. So as you can see, I've always sort of been lucky in the way I was sort of guided to taking classes,
mm-hmm.
becoming a bookmaker at Madison, ending up in Madison, John Bennett taking the class together at that exhibition, getting into the Hamidis class, and then Prudy saying, it's crazy for you to continue in this path. You should get a degree. Because
mm-hmm.
by then, I can't, 79, I would have been 20, 23. I'd left school thinking I wasn't going to go back.
And why was that?
Well, I had wanted to be an architect, and there was no formal way to be an architect at Colgate.
Mm-hmm.
So I was an English major, and then I knew a couple of people who had end up going to design school from Colgate, but I was unhappy with what I was doing. It didn't seem fulfilling.
Okay.
And I couldn't see where it was going to end up, so I left. And then during the summer, I met the woman who I came eventually followed my heart to Madison.
Mm-hmm.
So that's probably the best way to say it. It wasn't the first. And then eventually, I met the woman I'm married to now.
Mm-hmm.
She was a grad student here, so that's fairly typical.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, she by then, that was 80. By 1980, see, I took Hamidis' class in 79,
mm-hmm.
and I was hooked, line and sinker. And the shop steward was Kathy Keene, and she had a benefactor in Winnetka. Whose name escapes me at the moment, but that's an interesting story as well. So they were local benefactors, and they had an interest in graphic arts and painting, this couple in Winnetka, the wife in particular. And she had called up Kathy over Christmas and said, there's this funny printer in my neighborhood who's got a printing press for sale.
Uh-huh.
And so Kathy asked me, do you want to buy this press together? So we bought the press in January of 1980.
Okay.
And Kathy and Jim Escalante and I drove down and retrieved it.
Mm-hmm.
And so we set it up in my apartment. There was a little butler's pantry. And the press wouldn't fit this way. It would only fit lengthwise.
Okay.
And so that was in 80, the spring of 80, we set up the printing press. And she lived on Johnson. I lived in the building, which was, I think, Brearley Street. So that's where we printed books. She had her own press, I had my own press. And we were still taking classes. Uh-huh. So we felt like we had the best of both worlds. Because in the shop, there was basically one press that everyone was using.
Mm-hmm.
And as the semester wore on, there were 6-hour shifts. So you would go 12 to 6, 6 to 12, 12 to 6, 6 to 12. And I was still working nights then. So I would often print, get off work at 9 and print from 12 to 3.
Okay.
And there was two other students who were doing the same thing. One was a waitress, and the other, Jim Lee, who was an MFA. Barb was getting her undergraduate degree, like I was. Jim was getting his MFA, and he shot through the fastest of anyone. He took as many credits as he could year-round.
Okay.
So he did his MFA in 2 years. So the three of us got really, we bonded because we were printing pretty much from 9 to 3 in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
But now having my own press, meant that I wasn't dependent on that schedule. I could print when I was wanted to. And I'd bought a little bit of type. I was buying my own equipment. So I was somewhat independent.
Okay.
And though I was still taking classes, because by then I was a registered art student, so I needed to accumulate credits. And I would start taking other classes too, the required classes, painting, design. And I'd taken enough art classes at Colgate that fulfilled the basic requirements. But I still had a lot of credits to go. And then the other requirements in undergraduate, social studies. And, so, and by then, I'm not sure the exact dates, by 81 or 82, they had decided to reopen the Silver Buckle Press. It had been dormant.
Okay.
And John Bennett was hired to be the first director. Because he graduated with his MFA. And up to that point, you got an MFA and then you'd get a teaching job. Well, that's the way it had worked for a long time. But by that, it was breaking down profoundly by 81. Art departments were shrinking, not expanding. So all these talented grad students were not finding teaching jobs. Sometimes in any given year, only two or three would get a job. And it was a huge art department. In the graphics, it was a very, very, as it turns out, that's another massive stroke of luck, as I ended up in Madison, which is probably the premier graphics department in the country. So for probably 25 years, their grads had gone on to become the professors that were hiring new grads. So if you had an MFA print degree from Madison, that was gold. That was the gold standard. So that's another thing I inherited, this reputation. And but it was breaking down pretty quickly. I'd say between 80 and 84, there were very few jobs.
Okay.
And Jim graduated in the summer of probably 80, 81, probably 1980, and he took a job in Winnipeg for 2 years. And then he left there and went to Hartford. He's been there 30 years now. And that was true until, but it was sort of a shrouded secret. I think the expectation was, I'm going to get a teaching job. And when you couldn't, there was a lot of frustrated people, like, well, what am I going to do now? And that was never my ambition. And I was only getting my undergraduate degree. But for a lot of the MFAs, for some it was crushing. The reality, like, I'm not going to get a job. As talented as they were, that was the other thing. Everyone was so talented. And I don't want to jump ahead, but in 84, when Joe Wilfer, who had gotten his master's here, he filled in on a sabbatical replacement for Hamady. And he was the one who was like, the last thing you want is a teaching job. So everyone was like, well, maybe he's right. So I would say that one semester he was there. So eventually, Ruth Lingen then working for him, Kathy Keene, and Patty Scobie and her husband moved to Michigan, and paper molds and this. And so it was clear there were viable options in life other than being an art professor. And because this was such a vibrant, I mean, there was at least a major professor in every department of the graphic arts, from Hamady, offset, litho, relief printing, silkscreen, etching, lithography. And then Marjorie Kralik was teaching color in the Bauhaus method. So on one wing of that sixth floor, there were all those studios. And they all had grad students. But unlike the other side of academia, where the scientific side, if you're in grad school, if you're lucky, you're going to get some funding, because there's usually the academic side of life my wife's in. She's in computer science and engineering. So when you have a PhD come on, you can pretty much guarantee them funding. So all these MFAs were paying tuition. And there were a couple TA-ships, but those were really rare as well. So most of these people were self-funding. And Jim went through so quickly because he was determined to do that. He had enough resources to get through as quickly as possible.
And that was saving money then?
Saving money. And I think they weren't as rigorous about the residency requirement. to do, you had to take, I think to get a master's or PhD, you had to be on campus so many semesters, a minimum. And then it was, you know, tuition dollars. They didn't want people shooting through faster than they should.
Yeah.
So.
So did you have any thoughts as you were going through your classes of what you wanted to do when you were done?
Yes, I was convinced. I swallowed it all. I was going to be a bookmaker.
Okay.
And I had the press. I got to see the thing. As I went from being a student working in a communal print shop to having my own printing press.
Mm-hmm.
And then Kathy and I moved with two other students in that summer when our lease ran up. When her lease ran up, mine did. Four of us, one of them was a painter in the art department. Four of us rented two apartments out on Carling Drive, on the very far west side. We were still in Madison, near Fitchburg. We were on the border of Fitchburg.
Mm-hmm.
And so we rented two apartments. We ate. The women slept upstairs, and we cooked upstairs, and downstairs was, one bedroom was a painting studio, one bedroom was my bedroom, and then the living room kitchen was our print studio.
Okay.
And that we did that for 2 years. And by then I was working other jobs. I worked at Dottie Dumplings, and I was cooking because I knew Jim and Mary, I was cooking at the sorority.
Okay.
And then I was working at the Silver Buckle Press. So I had these jobs to fit in, but I was printing, always printing, whenever I had any free time.
Uh-huh.
I was printing on my press because it was there. When I woke up in the morning, it was there, and I went to bed, and it was there. And there were a couple other people. Chuck Alexander, or Charles Alexander, had a press
mm-hmm.
in town. That was about it, though.
Did people come to use your press then, too, or were they mostly using the one in the...
I think I was probably following the Walters model, is that I've always described myself as a printer and a publisher.
Mm-hmm.
So I would, and it was through the Woodland Pattern in Milwaukee that we would go to poetry reading. So I was meeting poets, writers
mm-hmm.
in Milwaukee, and I mean the model was pretty simple. If you write an author and said, I'd like to publish something of yours, you're going to get response fairly quickly. There's going to be very, very little delay. And then I had all these friends who were MFA printmakers,
mm-hmm.
who were happened to be bookmakers. Half of them were bookmakers on this as well. So I would have to meet the writer. I'd get a manuscript and I'd show it to one of these friends, and they would always come up with something
mm-hmm.
that I hadn't seen. And then when I was typesetting, other design ideas would occur. So that's why I've always described myself as a printer and a publisher. I generate. But I let them. I like getting to the point of ignition, where I've got the manuscript,
mm-hmm.
I've given it to an artist, and I was getting more involved in the structure of the book. There's plenty for me to do as a printer,
mm-hmm.
and yet it's really between the structure the book takes because of the internal fabric of the book, the illustrations, the artwork, and then the writing between those three. There's plenty to manage there, and I love that part of it.
Okay.
And yet, that was a model that has really been since the English arts and crafts period, but it was more self-publishing.
Mm-hmm.
I was never felt a need to be a writer. I enjoyed the designing
mm-hmm.
and the publishing part of it, and the printing. So a bookmaker describes what I do
okay.
in my mind, but printing and publishing is what. If you say you're a bookmaker, then depending on how old a person is, it can have two different, radically different meanings. So I say printer-publisher.
Okay. Can you talk a little bit about how you choose which binding or structure for the book for a particular project?
Well, in many cases, it comes out of the hand-setting of the manuscript.
Okay.
A good example would be a book where book I published in Maine. I met a writer, a British writer, who was from the very northern part of England. And he was living on the coast of Maine with his wife in a little trailer. And they live near two local conservation parks. And I've met very few Brits that weren't habitual walkers. They love to walk. And even though he was from a very northern industrial city, living in Maine, opened his eyes to the natural world. And it's beautiful along the coastline. It's quintessential, what you imagine it would be. So I've always been interested in poets of the landscape. So he submitted a manuscript, and there were lots of where the land meets the shoreline. Mm-hmm. So I have a paper maker that I met over the years who lives in Maine now. I met her in Indiana. So I will say to Katie, this is what I'm thinking about. I'd like you to make a text paper, because I like combining different colors, different mm-hmm. kinds of paper. So I had this green paper, very subtly green with a lot of blue fleck in it. It's a German paper. So I'd like something, and then I use Japanese papers and printmaking papers. So there's a range of papers in the book, depending on the poems. So the certain poems will go on certain papers. The Japanese papers are more transparent, so when you turn the page, you see the backside of the type. So I like, and this again, which I was suckled on with Hamity, you know, playing with all the facets of the book. The paper is really critical, I think, because of Hamity's influence. We learn how to make paper. We can see what paper can do as a very subtle design element. So what I use Katie for is the cover papers or papers that are going to be an integral part of the binding. So in this book, I said to Katie, I'd like you to design a paper that would suggest where the land meets the ocean, the water. And I want the paper to have something in it, something that there's always a skir between the high and the low tide line along the sand beach, these pebble beaches, which are a defining feature of eastern Maine where I live. Very few sand beaches. So I want there to be inclusions in the paper, so it's going to have some texture to it. And that's all I'll tell her. And we've worked together long enough so that she has an instinct for what. And she'll make up some samples and send them to me, and I'll say, this is the one. And then Mark, in the poem, during these walks, there's a lot of evergreens along the coast, but there are also birch stands. So several of the poems have birch. Well, birch, I had a piece of birch bark. I thought, well, the green she came up with for the cover, I'd like to, so you've got this green with these inclusions, and then when you open it up, there's no point in just going from the page right to the text. You want to kind of create this space, this environment. So I sent Katie a piece of birch bark. I said, why don't you make an end sheet paper like a piece of birch bark? And she wrote back and said, which color? Because if you peel back the birch, there's like a tan color, and there's more of an orange. So I thought, well, that's perfect. I mean, that was when I peeled it back. Once I got the other piece that I didn't send her and peeled back, well, I know what she's talking about. And they look lovely together. I said, well, make them both. Mm-hmm. So when you open the book, you have this green, and then you have this lovely tan, and then this orange, and then you get into the body of the book. And that's, again, something that Hamity said, you know, it should be a quiet transition between, with paper. Mm-hmm. And the papers that she makes are very stout, and they're impervious, because some cover papers, you know, just the natural grease in your fingers get, or the abrasion of handling a book. So her papers are tough and extraordinarily beautiful. They're very tactical and visually appealing. So I pretty much confine my books, and yet they're very strong. So you can ask them to do things that you would worry about the bending, the back and forth, that eventually there would be abrasion and then a tear. So she's been an essential part of my books structurally.
And how long have you been working together?
Probably since 87, okay. When I moved to for 30 years.
So can you talk a little bit more about, finishing up your degree here? Mm-hmm. Because you were going part-time, how long did it end up taking you to get your degree?
Well, I just reminded Jim when he drove me over here. The summer of 87, my wife was finishing up her PhD. She lived, it was in landscape, had a huge studio in the basement of Steenbach. And so that's where, and she came to grad school in 81, the fall of 81, and was funded, PhD with a program. So she was paid to go to grad school, like, mm-hmm. which is fairly typical. And so she had came here to get a master's, and then she fell into this program that really started, it didn't only start here in Madison, but they had some key faculty here, Ben Neiman, Nick Chrisman, and Barbara Buttonfield. And then there was David Woodward, and then there was someone in civil engineering, this Geographic Information System,
okay.
GIS. So this was 1981. It was a new thing. And she fell into that. So she once she finished her master's, which was on sand and gravel, she went right into GIS. So she decided, we were married by then, she said, I'm going to go for my PhD. So that that went from like 83 to 87. So 87 was launch date.
Okay.
I think of all of our friends, I was one of the last ones, we were one of the last ones living here. Tracy was still living here. Jim had taken a job in Missouri mm-hmm. in 81. Jim Lee had long gone. Kathy had gone. Ruth had gone. Patty Scobie and her husband moved early that summer. So she was finishing up her PhD.
And what was her PhD in?
In the environmental resources.
Okay.
So suddenly I had to close. I had to wrap things up. And I had all these credits. I had probably 160 credits. You only need them like 120.
Okay.
If you do it right. So, but then not all the parts fit.
Okay.
So I was literally one credit shy in social studies, and one credit shy in biological sciences. So I went to the dean. I said, "What do I do?" And he said, "Well, you got to find a class. If you can find a class that satisfies both, I'll split the credits." So I did. I found a class on environmental history.
Okay.
That was taught by Bob Ostergren in the geography department, because I'd taken several geography classes, historical geography, mm-hmm. it's eminently famous department. Well, we left in a panic, a mad rush. Katie had her thesis defense. We loaded up the truck and moved. And she still had corrections, and she was teaching full time, and then she had till December in her mind. They said, she was all but dissertated.
Uh-huh.
Well, actually, she had dissertated. She defended, but she had corrections to make. So she was making her corrections in the fall and teaching. Normally, when they hire new faculty, they often don't have to teach for the first semester.
Okay.
So she was teaching a subject she really knew very little about. She was teaching a high-level math class.
Okay.
So she was 2 pages ahead of her students, who were all math computer majors, so it was a terrifying semester, and finishing up making her corrections. So I had a promise from the dean that this was going to happen, and when it didn't happen, I said, the hell with it. I don't care if I have a degree or not. As far as I'm concerned, I was happy. I was content. So in 92, when I came, Jim was teaching here by then, I came back and he said, well, Tiz, whatever happened, he'd completely forgotten this until this morning. So, did you get your degree? Because we had another friend who was in the same boat, but with her master's or her MFA.
Okay.
And I said, nah, didn't go through. And he loves fountain pens. And he sat forward and he raised his hand and said, I am God. He had the fountain pen. He was the undergraduate advisor for the art department. And this is what they do. They're the ones who say, if you get me, find a class that satisfies both, I'll divide the class. So with a stroke of a pen, he filled out the form, made sure that it was actually processed, and I got my diploma in the mail.
Wow.
Which I told him I store in my dictionary. So that's how I actually ended up with a physical transcript degree.
Okay.
And I was the only thing that disappointed me was how small it was. Katie got a nice big one. Of course, she got a PhD, but this thing's pretty small. But he'd completely forgotten that until okay. this morning. So I'm very grateful that, because, I was somewhat of an older student.
Mm-hmm.
And I was naive to think, well, I don't care. And in the art world, do you really need a degree? If you're not going to be teaching, do you need an MFA? And I had flirted with the idea of the MFA. Mm-hmm. Once Katie had said, oh, I'm going to go on for a PhD because it took another 3 years, I thought, well, maybe I should do an MFA. And I said, no. But all my friends would say, you don't need a degree. But it began to dawn on me that, well, they're saying that, but they all have degrees. So maybe it would be a good idea to get a degree. So that's what really emboldened me to think, you know. And then I was always thinking of Prudy Studer, because I think she'd retired by then. You know, I should follow up. I should see it through, because I know what she would have said. Damn fool. You've gotten this far. You've got like 140 credits. And because I was always working, I would sign up for class, and then 4 weeks in, I'd say, oh, this isn't what I thought it was. And I never went through the formal drop process.
Okay.
So I'd end up with an F.
Oh, no.
Apparently, I had the highest GPA of anyone with all these Fs on there. That's what I heard through my dean.
Uh-huh.
Because he said, you know, you can go back and plead. Some professors will just slam the door in your face, but you can go back and tell the professor what was going on, and they'll do a retroactive drop.
Okay.
Because he said, at some point, you might want, because I was like a 2.7, 2.8.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I just said, the hell with it. I'm not going to do that. I mean, this isn't something I'd brag about to my son, who's a much smarter kid than I was. He's a computer science major.
Uh-huh.
So academics, you know, the history. I love, my mom was a history teacher, so I've always loved history.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like what I'm learning myself, is that's fulfilling enough.
So then where did you say you ended up moving after your wife got a job?
We would go back. Once we started dating, I would take her to Maine.
Uh-huh.
In summer of 82, we went to Maine to visit my grandfather.
Okay.
And when I needed $300 to buy that printing press, I wrote a letter to my grandfather. I said, could you loan me $300?
Mm-hmm.
And he did, gladly. So we would go back. We'd pick the last 2 weeks of the summer to leave town. And Katie was, even though she's from Iowa, she did live in New Jersey for a while. Mm-hmm. She's always wanted to be on the coast, on the water. And so when she finished her PhD, as she was finishing it, she would go to conferences with other grad students. And she gave a presentation that impressed a faculty member at Orono, who invited her the spring of 87 to come give a presentation and consider a job. So she ended up getting the job at the University of Maine at Orono. It was a complete fluke. She hadn't gone to that conference, hadn't made that presentation. And they were in the same field. It was engineering. She had a job offer from Iowa State in natural resources. But they were going, Maine was allied with Santa Barbara and University of Buffalo for this National Center for Geographic Information. It was an NSF proposal. So all these schools were competing. They wanted to get this. It was a 10-year program. And Maine got it. Maine, Buffalo, and Santa Barbara got the... and actually, ironically, Wisconsin was in competition.
Okay.
So this was a big deal. It's the first time NSF said, this GIS is a viable future, research future.
Mm-hmm.
And they hired her because she came from Mattis, from Wisconsin. So that's why she's been there the whole time. And I just moved the press out there.
Okay. Can you talk a little bit about the name for your press originally? I know it was called Landlocked Press.
Well, that was sort of... Hamity was the Perishable Press Limited.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he's got a perfectly reasonable justification for it. John Bennett was the Gardy Lou Press. And Gardy Lou is what you yelled when you threw in the streets of London in the 1700s, which you'd yell Gardy Lou before you threw your waste out the window so someone below wouldn't get covered. So, and then other people, Kathy was Salient Seedling Press, and so I thought, well, I gotta come up with something spiffy. So where I live in Maine, in Portland, there's a giant lake, Sebago Lake, which has one of the few landlocked salmon populations, the very famous one. One of the lithography professors, when he found out my name was Landlock, he's a fisherman. He knew immediately what it meant, landlocked salmon.
Mm-hmm.
So I came up with this metaphor, the landlocked salmon. Even though it was landlocked, it survived. So I was thinking, well, this is a small press activity. So it was sort of a metaphor for me, the landlocked salmon. After the glaciation, the theory was that when the glaciers receded, the eggs ended up in the landlocked lake, and yet they were able to survive for generations. Because normally it was an Atlantic salmon, which leaves, typically is in a lake, goes down a stream, out into the ocean at some point in its life, unlike the Pacific one. It'll come back up the river, its ancestral river, and spawn, and then go back out to sea. It doesn't die. But this salmon had adapted to a landlocked environment. And so that was the metaphor, and it was just sort of saying, well, I'm from the East. But the longer I lived here, I realized, well, I'm living on an isthmus between two lakes. I'm living between Lake Michigan and the Mississippi. So when I moved back to Maine, all my friends, well, you can't be landlocked anymore. And by then I had started the Tadlin Books imprint. I felt like that was a more, I won't say honest, but it was a more bare bones Tadlin Books. And he was a Russian sculptor, Vladimir Tadlin, whose work I admired.
Okay.
So that's why I picked Tadlin. And I stopped using, I did a book in 92. It was the last landlocked press book. It was a Swedish book. And the writer was, again, a really strong writer of the landscape. I figured this would be the perfect book to end landlocked press. So I haven't used it since 92 when I printed this Swedish book.
Mm-hmm.
And continued. I started using Tadlin Books in 85.
Can you talk a little bit about how your artist books have evolved over the years, like how things have changed?
Well, when I was first starting out, I was printing primarily poetry,
mm-hmm.
editions of 100 to 250, and they were illustrated, but they were pretty straightforward poetry books. And yet poetry, you're not going to make a lot of money publishing poetry.
Mm-hmm.
But more than that, I began to feel, it wasn't until I met a writer in Maine who was a very good poet, he had his own press, and he published like I did. He said, the trouble with being a writer is, you're not fulfilled unless it gets published. I had all these artist friends who made prints, and primarily printmakers. When they're done with the print, they do another one. There's no like, oh, I got to get this print published. It's beginning, the middle, and an end. For a writer, it's getting published is everything. And it creates this horrible anxiety. And it began to occur to me that I might not be doing some of these writers any favors, because I would publish a book of theirs, and it's always difficult to sell, and so I had to make it the cheapest price possible. So I wasn't making any money off them. And it began to worry me that it wasn't really fulfilling for them either. Because, well, once it gets published, then how's it doing?
Sure.
And I've always, the way I negotiate with the writers, I'll give you 20% of the edition. And that's always, no one's ever objected to that. But again, it wasn't like I felt like a fraud, but I began to think, you know, this doesn't seem to be doing them any better. So I started to generate, I'd never done books of my own work because I'm not a writer. So I started to play around. By then I had been printing for so long and was comfortable with the medium that I started to play around with book structures and prints of my own to make my own books. So I'm halfway now. Unless I have a direct contact with a writer, I'm not publishing poetry, not publishing writers anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked with three writers significantly over the years who I had day-to-day contact with, or a more personal, enriched relationship with: Carl Jung, Mark Rutter, and Joe Napora. And I didn't feel like I didn't have those feelings of guilt or anxiety about publishing people, because it is difficult to publish poetry, and so I think I became less of a publisher and more of a book printer.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't use the publishing part as much as I used to. And when I say I would work intimately with Mark Rutter, the current one, we've been working together since 2000. When he comes back in the summer, he moved back to the UK. We we worked together in the studio. We'd have these printing sessions. And he's a part-time musician, so for him to come and work in the studio together, sometimes we'd be successful, sometimes things wouldn't work out. But it was never for him, it was never a waste of time. Mm-hmm. And we've done a whole host of projects together, small broadsides, books. We've done 4 books together and probably a dozen broadsides. And just the short amount of time that we're together, we're in the room together. Mm-hmm. And with Carl, it was a little bit different. He would just give me the manuscript mm-hmm. and then allow me to make changes as it went along, because his books are so open to, they're so fertile. The texts to me are so fertile that I would get halfway through the book and say, ooh, I wish I'd done this. Well, he'd say, well, he didn't say, well, why start over again? But it never bothered him that I might say, I think I'm going to take a different direction with this book. But if you said that with some writers, they'd say, well, does that mean the book's not going to come out next month? I mean, there was always this pressure. And I felt it wasn't fair to the writers for me to allow things to meander, because the book was actually demanding those. That's why I became more sensitive. The book itself was saying, no, this is what I want to be. And I think it enriches the book. So suddenly getting 250 copies was less fulfilling than allowing this book to emerge on its own. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that makes sense. So my books have gotten smaller. Mm-hmm. The editions are smaller. They're more involved structurally. And they take place over a greater period of time. That's why you have to keep... I may have, at the current rate I'm going, I've got 12 different books going at different rates of completion. So it still comes out to about a book a year.
Okay.
But I feel like one feeds off the other. And that's, again, something Hamity sort of instilled in us. Some years he'd be very, he'd do small books, a lot of small books, and then he might do a book that might take 2 or 3 years. So that part didn't bother me. But when you have I mean this just sort of figuratively, when you don't have a writer who's counting on this book arriving to sort of get this sense of fulfillment, that takes some pressure off. Mm-hmm. And I felt that was the part that was grating on the writers, that was frustrating for them. And I thought, well, am I doing them any favors?
So how do you find people now to collaborate with?
Well, I've narrowed the field. Mm-hmm. I've narrowed the field to the people I've worked with the longest.
Okay.
And I'm still working with the same collaborators I had when I first started.
Okay.
So if you took the first 3 years, I'm still working with those same people. Mm-hmm. But now I'm one of them. Now that I don't mind contributing mm-hmm. the graphics to the book. So I'm still working with people like Barb and Jim, and that's from those, they were the three of us back in 79, that first semester, and 79 and 80, when Barb was finishing up her degree. She left and went to Twin Rocker, which is where I met Bernie and Katie, my paper makers. So I'm still working with the same people.
Can you talk about one of the books that we have here at the Kohler Art Library, Fish Tales, that you mm-hmm. worked on with Barb?
Well, that came out after the collaboration the Silver Buckle did of the Surrealist game, but The Exquisite Corpse.
Mm-hmm.
No, what was the book called? The Exquisite something.
Yeah, it was called the... that's what it was called.
Exquisite something.
Corpse. And then there was another one that was correct.
The exquisite horse. Right. The Exquisite Corpse. So I visited her after the book came out, mm-hmm. after that project came out. And we were sitting in the Silver Buckle, and we sort of dreamed up this, because we had worked together on books unofficially. You'll know, if you read the colophons, you'll see that it's very incestuous. Mm-hmm. Thanks to so-and-so. So we had done things not directly together, mm-hmm. and we decided, let's make it official. So the model was the Exquisite Corpse. Why do I think that's wrong? Anyway, Exquisite. And we came up with the project just sitting across from each other like this.
Okay.
And again, it goes back to the landlocked salmon.
Mm-hmm.
So we had three elements: the text, the fish, and then something underneath that. And that came together fairly quickly.
Okay.
And she came out to Maine with her printed pages, and I was still on the press. She came out for a week in 93, I believe. Then we had to decide how to bind. We had already decided it was going to be an accordion. But she just received a Fulbright to go to Leipzig. So she wasn't going to be around to bind the book. And that structure is fussy. It has to be very precise. And we had met a binder, Dan Kelm, who lives out in the East Hampton. He's in East Hampton. We knew who he was, and that was his specialty. So we invited him up to visit while we were in Maine together, and that's when we worked out he was going to bind it for us.
Okay.
But that was a huge step, because it was, for back then, it was $50 a copy, as it turned out, and that was a lot of money. One thing about binding old books is you don't have to pay anybody.
Yeah.
And then she was gone in Leipzig, so it was a good thing to hand it off to somebody. That's the first time I'd ever handed a book off to somebody. And so that was a bit scary. We had to write, both had to write big checks. But again, it was just one of those happy things. We had, someone wrote a review of that book.
Mm-hmm.
And said, you know, and these kinds of projects that can end in tears, but because we weren't looking over each other's shoulders. We left after this initial consultation. We had where we knew where things had to fit,
mm-hmm.
and that was it. It wasn't until we got together, I think a year later, that we saw what we'd come up with, and that was also the first time that I had illustrated anything. I certainly had lots of memories about what I had printed before. See, I always did the printing.
Mm-hmm.
The artist would give me things, plates, woodcuts, and I would do the printing. So I was not uncomfortable printing. And that, I hadn't really thought about it, because I had done my contribution for that project. I'd done the head. But then I thought, well, I actually have to knuckle down here and come up with 12 different images, and they all have to work. So that was a bit scary. So I had each page in my mind. I envisioned it. Okay, this is my Lisitsky page. This is my Tom Phillips page. This is my Dada page. So I had in my mind, how am I going to figure out what kind of imagery I'm going to come up with? So that's how I did it. I thought, okay, and then I got a text. One of the title page is a text from a. Jeanette Winterston. It's a line that has to do with the salmon.
Mm-hmm.
You can barely read it, because I didn't have permission to publish it. So it's kind of obscured. So that was a little bit unnerving, but at the end of it, I thought, well, I guess it worked out all right. So that was the first book I really had provided the illustrations for.
And where was the review?
It was in Bookways, and... there was a picture of the book in that, and then I had reviews in fine print and in Bookways. And I think in that issue there was another issue that was started by Bonnie Stoliker, I think, about collaboration. We were supposed to write about the collaborative process. And I had written an article for a magazine called Abracadabra, which came out of the West Coast, about a collaboration I'd done with a woman in Maine, The Seafarer. It's an Anglo-Saxon text. And I didn't have any trouble writing that, but when it came to writing this, suddenly I was like, I don't think I want to do this. But Carl Jung said, well, if you don't do it, I will.
Uh-huh.
So he's the one who wrote the article. Everyone else wrote about their collaboration, so Carl wrote this wonderful piece
uh-huh.
about how that Seafarer came together. And... And then there was another article about an exhibition of Hamidi's at Columbia College of student work, and I was in that show as one of the students.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I didn't see the show. There was a big show at the Westin called Room, I invert numbers, I think it was called 6451. It was the room number for the type shop.
Okay.
And that was a very, they had a nice, a big catalog, and I flew out. My dad was living in Milwaukee to see my dad and go to the opening. So that was a big deal. And we all wrote about our experience at Madison. So that's a good place to start. But this one at Columbia was about design problems. And I never saw the show.
Okay.
But it alerted a collector in Massachusetts, only collected books from New England bookmakers. So when I moved out there, I didn't raise my hand and start saying, here I am. Because a lot of people out there didn't have the advantage that I did, going to a place like Madison and meeting someone like Walter. They were kind of bumping along on their own.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like I'd gotten a critical jump start. I mean, I was able to make a great leap forward just being here. This great, I called it a vortex, this wonderful period, from 80 to 84, probably the best years to have been here for books. And so I didn't have any urge to shout about who I was. So that little review of that show alerted this collector in Massachusetts that I was in New England now. So he bought all the books that I was making in Bangor. That was important to him. And then my introduction to the main book world was a curator at the Portland Museum of Art. She was assistant curator of Princeton photographs. She was given a turn to have a show. They called it Perspectives. I think it was a way to encourage their scholarship. So she started in Portland. She knew some printers in Portland. And the printers in Portland said, well, then, if you're going to do that, you should meet so-and-so. So it went from a 4-person show to about a 12-person show. Okay. That covered the whole state. So she came up to see me and interview me. And that was in 90... That was in 89, I think.
Okay.
88 or 89. And that sort of announced to, the main... There are these bookmakers. There were some fine binders. Gray Perot, who's a classic bookbinder, and then some people like me. So that was the first time that I was really openly declared as a main bookmaker.
Okay.
But I try and stay out of the... Because underneath every other rock of Maine is a writer. And as soon as you say you're printing books, again, that whole, how could I get something published?
Uh-huh.
And one of the ways I avoid that is I've never set myself up to print things on commission. I've always wanted to have complete control over that.
Well, you mentioned that it was hard to sell poetry books, and you did have a background as a bookseller.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious, did you ever, and you mentioned Woodland Pattern, did you ever try selling books in bookstores, or did you...
Well, I would go to book fairs.
Okay.
And as my books became more elaborate, I realized that these book fairs... The absolute threshold someone is going to impulsively spend is 100 at the maximum.
Okay.
So when I show up with $200, $300, $400, $500 books,
mm-hmm.
they get a lot of interest. So I went to as many book fairs as I could because I felt that was the responsible thing to do. And it was also educational because when we were in 79 and 80, when we were starting out, our fellow art students were like, well, what do you do? And then when you say what you did, they say, well, what else do you do? And I said, well, this keeps me plenty busy.
Mm-hmm.
So there was really no book arts world, so to speak. It was confined in the more traditional fine arts. And yet our biggest customers were the New York, Philadelphia, Boston, San Francisco, people in the graphic design field who'd come up that way. They knew all about, they loved the fact we were using letterpress type.
Mm-hmm.
And someone was carrying the torch. So that worked out. Those were our biggest customers, were people in the design world, graphic art world. But as they started to retire and die off, they weren't replaced.
Okay.
So I started to think, well, what's the next generation? And I think a lot of people, as my books naturally became more involved structurally, I thought, well, it's got to really present itself in a myriad of way. Not beautifully printed type alone isn't going to carry any, isn't going to be sustaining. And so part of it wasn't motivated commercially. It was, by then I was thinking personally, this is the kind of book I want to make. But I thought, well, this might interest the new generation, because mm-hmm. it's so much easier now to get in. We used to have to typeset things by hand to get, then the computer came. That really changed everything. When you could suddenly keyboard different typefaces and software, PageMaker, that, I thought, this is the future. Mm-hmm. But it didn't happen right away. But I think it's starting to happen now. I think Ruth is seeing that in New York. These young kids, they're thoroughly versed in the computer, and then they see something like a Hamity book or a book that Ruth's done, or anyway, Patty or any one of us. They think, ooh, now this is interesting. So it took a lot longer to get to the point that I thought. I thought it was happen that would go from the old guard to the new guard, but it took a while. It took quite a while. And then the book arts world changed. Dealers were comfortable letting you give them a 10 to 20%. They all want 50% now.
Okay.
So that makes the books more expensive. Mm-hmm. And then there was just a tsunami of artist books, mostly one of a kinds. And it kind of swamped out the books that I'm interested in making. And those are fabulously expensive. I saw that at the book fair at Pyramid Atlantic the year that Congress shut down. So, and it was at the Corcoran Gallery. And I had been to the first Pyramid Atlantic book fair. And then I think a couple of years, two or three years had lapsed. And I could see what was coming next. It was going to be this tidal wave of artists' books that were big, elaborate productions, and very expensive, and the dealers behind them. And I thought, that's not the direction I want to go in. And that's also the same period that people like Julie Chen, they came out of that. Or Haiti Kyle. Certainly Claire was always making books all along, but her books started to change as well. The structure was one way to go. And yet they were still had their foot in the sort of fine press. Mm-hmm. And so I saw that there were still plenty of good books being made, but I could see this. Who's, you know, if you go on, I think it's Vamp and Tramp, you mm-hmm. see their list of books, and you scroll through, there is a certain kind of book now that is the artist book. And I've always been encouraged by my peers to keep making the books I make, because it's the text. Mm-hmm. And it's, again, those three writers, Jonah Porro, Mark Rutter, but especially Carl Jung was such a... And he was translating Mexican texts, Anglo-Saxon, Chinese. So he was... That, again, appealed to my sort of classical side, the texts. They kept saying, keep making the books you're making.
Mm-hmm. Well, since we're talking about different kinds of artist books, I wondered if maybe you could tell me in your own words what you think an artist book is.
Well, we used to, when we did Breaking the Bindings, mm-hmm. I think there were two metaphors. One was the standard Hamity, a book is a multiple and sequential picture plane that cannot be altered by the viewer mm-hmm. or reader. And then someone said, well, Ezra Pound described a book as being a ball of light in one's hand. And Carl Jung would say, well, what the hell do you mean by that? But I always took it, it should just open your eyes. A book should open your eyes. Mm-hmm. And I think I revert to those definitions now. Because I'm very broad. Because the fine press, you know, there was fine press, they were very skeptical of, well, what do you mean a book artist? I'm comfortable saying I'm a book artist. So if backed into a corner, I pull out the printer publisher. So I think I'm more, I was such a good printer in type. I love setting type, I love printing type, and not a lot of the people who were printmakers enjoyed that, so they were very happy to have me come along and say, would you help me with this book, because it meant I was doing the typeset, which I love to do. Mm-hmm. So I was a really good printer, but I could also see there was a side of this that was called the cult of the perfect impression, You know, that's really what it's all about. How well is it printed? Mm-hmm. And Hamdi taught us how to typeset. That's what distinguishes the Hamdi students. It's not only good printers, but we know how to handset type. And the old guard could see that. You know, we letter space things with papers, thins, brasses. And that really, once you start doing that, it really opens your eyes to the way letter forms fit. Mm-hmm. So I think my impression of my definition of a artist book is as wide open as it ever has been. Mm-hmm. But I do recognize that there is a certain kind of book that dealers love because they're expensive and they're going to get 50%. So I'm more interested in going to book fairs now. My threshold is 300 to 500, which is still a lot of money. Mm-hmm. But I like selling directly to people. Okay. So if a dealer wants to buy a book for me, I'm saying, you're going to pay the same price as anyone else. I'm not giving you a discount. And that hasn't been a problem, because my editions have gotten smaller. See, by the time I give 20% to the writer, and depending on the artist, I might give 20% there. And then I've been... the editions get smaller. Mm-hmm. So I don't have as many to sell as... The books I've done with Mark, I'm always like... When I get down, I finish buying them, I'm like, is this all there is? There's only 45? I thought we did 80. You know, so that's kind of crushing. To think, wow, there's only 44 of these. Damn. But by the time we print these sessions, you know, you get a lot of wastage. Not wastage, but you want every book to be the same.
Sure.
And I'm surprised often I get that question. Why is there this necessity that they should all look the same? I say that's just part of the tradition. And that would sometimes happen when you would help someone hang a show, as the grad students, and they would give you a print, or the rare time that you felt like you wanted to buy a print to really, and then you'd get the print and you'd see the one that was in the show and they were radically different, and you think, this isn't really the print. I want that print, but this is the print I have. That I realize that's why you try and make them all the same. Uh-huh. Well, I put that in the show because it's a better print. Oh, okay, I didn't know that.
Well, how would you say that your time as a UW student affected your career as an artist?
It was transforming. It was absolutely transforming. And I think that window I was here, 79 to 84, was probably the best time. There were other people that certainly came through before and since. Mm-hmm. But I think there was such a crunch of activity. It was on autopilot. Now, Hamdi was the Pied Piper. And I think the breaking the bindings was really institutionally, because he was getting a lot of resistance in the art department. Well, where are you doing in that room? It was a locked room. Mm-hmm. They were very suspicious. Paper making? Setting tight, they were very suspicious of it. That's more of a craft. And so I don't think... And then...
Who are they?
His colleagues.
Okay.
And truthfully, I know how academia works more now because my wife's 30 years. A lot of the faculty would go out and do workshops. Damer, especially Colescott, and I'm sure Meeker. And... They would bring in the young blood. They would go out and spread the word, and they'd get undergraduates to come here to get their graduate degree. So there was always that possessive quality. This is my grad student.
Okay.
And then they would see some of these grad students would get diverted or distracted, like, ooh, I'm going to make books. So I think there was always some of this colleague tension.
Okay.
And Walter certainly did his share of that as well, but... It was a good gene pool for him to draw on, because each area had this pool of grad students, and I don't think it's ever been the same since then, having so many. I think at one point there were over 50 print grads, and I don't know what it is now, but I bet it's a fraction of that. So I think the whole structure of art education has changed. They'd retired, and they were all from a different generation. Many of them had gone to traditional art schools, like Wilde, the other painter. They'd sort of been to commercial schools, mm-hmm. where they actually teach them things. and it was kind of nebulous. I remember taking some class, painting classes and some design classes, where the professors were really loosey-goosey, like, okay, I just want you to know you're all going to get an A. And I was like, what? Because you didn't get an A from Walter unless you deserved it. And I had a drawing teacher who was Richard Long, who was, if you got an A from him, boy, you would work your ass off. So there was that kind of loosey-goosey side of it. And yet there was a whole side of the department that I wasn't aware of, other than hearing the metals department was really. And then I took for granted they had a woodworking. They had two full professors teaching woodworking. And there was only one of seven programs in the whole country. So the fact that I was at Madison, they had this really famous metals, they had Fenster and Eleanor Modi. And then you had the two, Breckenridge and, what was his name? I've met people say, oh, you went to Madison. They think of wood or they think of metals.
Okay.
So it was a great place to be. And again, it was just blind luck. I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, it does. Is there anything else that you'd like to add?
Well, it is interesting to look back and just say how damn lucky I was. I mean, you earn your luck.
Uh-huh.
And but the fact that I'm in Milwaukee for a family reason, and I booked an extra day so I could come up to see Jim. We all do that for each other. I think we're very close. And I think it frustrates some people. There are some printers who think, you guys are nothing but a cult. They say it with some affection.
Well, thank you so much, Walter.
That was my pleasure.